For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site. It's June 14th in Malachim Beis. We are up to Perek Dal, chapter 4. This parak is a haftorah, Parshas Vayera. We have spoken about this before with a Chanukah shir. Several years ago, we spoke about this particular parak, but we'll go through it now in the context of Malachim itself. One of the women who was a wife of the Bnei Hanavim, one of the prophets, cried out to Elisha, saying, "Avdecha ishi meis, your servant, my husband, died. Ve'atoyadatu, and you know, ki avdecha, or you knew, ki avdecha yareis Hashem, that your servant feared Hashem. Ve'hanoshe ba, and the creditor is coming. Va'kachas es shnei ladai lo la'avadim, to take my two sons for him as slaves, because I can't pay. So he's coming now to take them as slaves." The Gemara tells us, who is this woman? So she's the wife of one of the Nevi'im. That's fine. But the thing that really tips us off is that she calls her husband Yare Es Hashem, one who fears Hashem, someone who's known as a person who fears Hashem. And the person, the Navi that we are familiar with, that is called a Yare Hashem, who anybody remember? Ovadia. Is Ovadia the Navi? Now, we had Ovadia before, and Ovadia also has his own sefer. It's one parak long. It's the Haftorah from Parshas Vayishlach. And he was featured in the story with Eliyahu HaNavi, when Achav, when Eliyahu took away the rain, and then he went into hiding, and then Achav wanted to search the country for Eliyahu, so he took Ovadia. Ovadia was the head of Achav's household, and he went in one direction, Achav went in one direction, Ovadia went in the other direction, looking for Eliyahu. In the process, Ovadia meets Eliyahu, and Navi Hashem tells Eliyahu to show himself to Ovadia. And then Eliyahu tells Ovadia to go get Achav. After a little bit of exchange there, he does. And then they go to Har HaKarmel, to Mount Carmel, for the confrontation, showdown between Eliyahu and the Nevi'e Habal. That was the story with Ovadia. Ovadia, we know that he hid 100 Nevi'im when Izebel killed out the Nevi'im. Ovadia took 100 Nevi'im and he hid them, 50 in one cave and 50 in another cave, and he provided for them for food and water. Problem is, as we mentioned at the time, that 100 people, to feed 100 people, you need money. It's not easy to add 100 mouths to your annual budget. And here he had to single-handedly feed these 100 Nevi'im. So the way he did so is he borrowed money. He had to borrow money. So here the creditor is coming to collect on the debt. He had run up a huge debt in supporting these 100 Nevi'im, and the creditor is coming to collect on the debt. Now, the creditor is also someone well known. It is Yehoram, the son of Achav. Yehoram himself, who takes over for his father as king, he is the creditor. And he wants his money back. And since he can't get it back, he wants to take Ovadia's sons as slaves. But more than that, Ovadia had to borrow money from Yehoram. Yehoram was unwilling to lend the money for free, and therefore Yehoram did the avera of charging interest to a fellow Jew. He did the aver of charging ribis, of charging interest to a fellow Jew. And he would only lend money to Ovadia if Ovadia would pay interest on the loan. Now the halacha is that if a Jew borrows money from a Jew with interest, there is an avera for the lender, and there's an avera for the borrower. It's also an avera for the borrower to borrow with interest from a fellow Jew. So really, Ovadia was not allowed to borrow the money from Yehoram. Just as Yehoram wasn't allowed to lend it, Ovadia wasn't allowed to borrow it. However, because it was pikuach nefashos, it was a matter of life and death to take care of these prophets, these Nevi'im. They couldn't leave the caves, otherwise they'd be killed by Izevel, ostensibly Yehoram's mother. So he needed to support them, so that's why Ovadia was allowed to transgress the Torah, because it was for a life and death situation. And borrowing with interest is not one of the averas for which you give up your life, and certainly not the lives of other people. So he did the avera to save these 100 Nevi'im. But that doesn't justify it for Yehoram. Yehoram was doing the terrible avera. So here, he's coming to collect on that debt. Now, later we will see that the circumstances of Yehoram's death will reflect the fact that he took interest from Ovadia. Right now Yehoram's alive and well. But later when he is killed, the circumstances of his being killed will indicate that he is being punished for having taken interest from Ovadia. So just if you want to think about generationally, the first generation is Achav is the king, Eliyahu is the Navi, and Ovadia is the head of Achav's household, who's also a Navi, not level of Elisha, of Eliyahu, but he's still obviously a Navi. And then the next generation, you have Yehoram, the son of Achav, is now the king. Elisha, who is Eliyahu's primary Talmud, primary disciple, he's the new Navi. And the sons of Ovadia, these are all the next generation. The wife of Ovadia is still the previous generation. So she comes to Elisha and says that I'm about to lose my children as slaves for paying off this debt.
Do we know her name?
We do not know her name. At least I don't know her name. I don't think it is stated. I don't think so.
Yeah, we have any idea how long he would have hidden these?
That I don't know either. It's a good question. I don't know. Pasuk Beis, verse 2. Vayomer Eleha Elisha. Elisha said to her, Ma e'esalach. What should I do for you? Hagidi li ma'esh lach babayis. Tell me, what do you have in the house? A bracha means literally to increase. Bracha means to increase. Klala, curse, means to decrease. That's what those words literally mean. So Elisha wants to give the wife of Ovadia a bracha. But a bracha, which means to increase, can't start with nothing. To start with something, and then it can increase. So he says, what do you have in the house? Fatoma, she said, and she said, Ein l'shifchas chachol babayis, your maidservant has nothing in the house, ki'im asuch shaman, except for a small, very small flask of oil. That's all I have. That's it. There is nothing else in the house. Vayomer, Elisha said, l'chi shali lach keli min hachutz, go and borrow utensils from outside, meaning from neighbors. Well, it says explicitly, me'es kol shechinayich, from all of your neighbors, kelim reikim, empty utensils. Borrow empty utensils. Al tamiti, do not borrow just a few. Get as many empty utensils as you possibly can. Fill your home with empty utensils. Uvas, and you will come. Visagart hadeles badechu vad bonaich, you'll close the door in front of you and your sons. Viatzakt al kol hakelim o'ele, and you will pour onto all of these utensils. I mean, you'll pour from your little flask of oil into all of these empty utensils. V'hamole tasi, and the full one, you will move away. Which means that what you're going to do, let me say a good example, make sure this is closed tightly, is you're going to pour, and with the little flask of oil, you're going to fill up a borrowed utensil. When the borrowed one is full, you will move that one away and take another one and put it underneath the flask of oil. You will not move the flask of oil that is pouring. That will stay where it is. You will only move the other utensils, constantly filling one up, moving it away, filling another one up, moving it away. That's what you're going to do. But do not move the flask of oil. The Medrash says, because the flask of oil was going to now get a bracha, that it would be like a mayan. It would be like a spring, like a spring of water, but it's going to be oil. And as if it's coming up out of the ground and going through this flask and into the utensils. Now, when we talk about oil, we could talk about coming out of the ground, but that's not the kind of oil we're talking about here. This is olive oil. So it's a nace, of course, that the flask is going to keep on pouring, but it's going to be like it is a mayan, like it is a spring. A spring does not move. A spring stays where it is. So you're just going to let it continue to pour and keep moving the other utensils underneath the small flask of oil. He makes it a point to say you will close the door. This is an important point because, as Rashi tells us, kavod hanes hu, it is honor of the miracle, lavo behatsneya, that it should come in modesty, that it should be without fanfare. A miracle, if Hashem chooses to make it a public miracle, that's Hashem's business. But if someone is going to perform a miracle, it is the kavod of the nes that it be done with tznius, with modesty. It's an important point to be aware of, that having the merit to have a miracle happen obviously is a big deal. Most people don't get miracles. In the event that a miracle is going to take place, the proper way that it be done is with as much modesty as possible, with as little publicity as possible. That's the way it's supposed to be done. Now, we have a concept called Pirsume Nisa. Pirsume Nisa on Hanukkah and other times is to publicize the miracle. But publicizing the miracle doesn't mean when it is happening. Pirsume Nisa means publicizing the fact that Hashem did a miracle for us and we are thanking Hashem for what He did for us. That's Pirsume Nisa. But at the moment of the miracle, if it is within one's power, one tries to diminish the miracle as much as possible. So sometimes you have fascinating, incredible stories of great people where unbelievable things happen for them. Whether they are open miracles, whether they're not quite miracles, but there are special things that have happened. We know these things do happen to the great ones. However, the very often we find that people who have great things happen do not do it with fanfare and publicity. They do it quietly. So part of it is because to be a great person, you have to be a humble person. Humble people do not call attention to themselves, don't walk around saying, "Hey, look what happened to me." They keep it quiet. But more than that, it's a kavod of the nes itself that it remain quiet, that it not be something that is publicized. Now this is important because we're going to see later that Gehazi, Elisha's Talmud, Elisha's student, does not adhere to this rule. Pasuk, hey, verse 5. Vatelech me'ito, she went from him, vatiskor hadeles ba'ado uvad bonel, she closed the door in front of her and her children. The Navi doesn't tell us about her collecting the utensils, but she does. Heim magi shime laha, they would bring the utensils to her, v'him motzakes, and she would pour. So she just kept on pouring, while they would continually bring her the utensils. Once they were full, they would move them away, bring in other ones instead. Vayhi kimlo sakelim, and it was when the utensils were full, v'tomer el bina, she said to her son, hagish aleod keli, bring me another utensil. Vayomer Elel, he said to her, Ain't no Kelly, there are no more. That's it. We filled them all up. And then when he said that, Vayamod Hashem, and the oil stopped. So the miracle knew when to shut itself off. It kept going, and then as soon as there were no more, it was done. The Gemara tells us, Vayamod Hashem, has a dual meaning. it means that the oil stopped, because amod, to stand, has two implications. If a person is sitting down and then a person stands up, so amida means to move from a sitting position to a standing position. It's to go up. But if a person is walking and they stop, that's also called amod, to stand still. So amod, amida, can imply to go up. It can also apply to stand still, to stop one's movement. Here, the simple meaning is, vayamod hasham, it stopped the movement. It was pouring, and now it stopped. Like a person is walking, and they stop. That's amod, stop. But the dual meaning is, it went up. That oil went up in value. The price of oil spiked. Again, not the kind of oil we're used to, but the price of olive oil spiked at this moment, which was part of the miracle. Because remember, the purpose of this oil is so she can support herself. She can pay off the debt. So the whole purpose here is financial. It's for money. So not only did she end up with a lot of oil, but she ended up being one of the very few people who had oil. The price of oil spiked suddenly. There was a dearth of oil, and she became one of the few people who had an abundance of oil to sell. So all of a sudden, she has a very, very high commodity. Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. Va'tavo va'tageid l'isho Elokim. She came and she told the Isho Elokim, the man of Hashem, which is Elisha. And Rashi tells us she went to ask him, should she sell or should she wait for the price to go up higher? Elisha was doubled here as a financial consultant. Vayomer, he said, Lechi michri es Hashem, and go sell the oil. Vishami es nishyech, and pay off your debts. Va'at uvanayech, and you and your sons, tichyi banosor, you will live with the rest of the money. You will not need any more parnasa. You will not need any more livelihood. The sale of this oil will take care of you for the rest of your life. That's it. You're done. The oil will take care of you. In fact, Rashi says a very cryptic statement over here that it will take care of you. Rashi says there's enough for you and your sons to live on. Ad sheyechayu hamesim. Until the dead are resurrected. I'm not sure what that means. As I don't know if that's literal, that it is until the resurrection of the dead, and that there is a family somewhere that is living off of this oil, and that there's some sort of Jewish family that simply does not need to work. I don't know the answer. I don't know. But that's the statement that Rashi says here, that it will stand you, it will take care of you until the dead are resurrected. So this story is told, the simple meaning of why the story is told, as we've been saying until now, is the Navi is listing the miracles performed by Elisha. And here you have yet another miracle, the miracle of the oil, that he was able to go and go and go and go nonstop to take care of the wife of Ovadia. We spoke about this story relative to Hanukkah because the parallel to Hanukkah is obvious, that the oil went longer than it should have, that it kept on going, that with Hanukkah that it kept on burning when it should have been used up, and here that it kept pouring when it should have been used up. So we discussed that comparison, although there is more to it. Yes?
This commentary here says that the Midrash comments the latter blessing about the Tehiyas Hamesim, because that was an additional blessing she got, because she went to ask him whether she went back to the proper person.
So it was a reward to her for going back to ask.
It was an additional.
Okay, very nice. Good. Okay, thank you. Pasuk Ches, verse 8. Vayihi Hayom, and it was a day, came to a day. By Avor Elisha el Shunem. And Elisha passed to Shunem. He was traveling around and he came to Shunem. We know that Shmuel Hanavi, used to go from place to place to judge the Jewish people. He went from place to place to place to place. Elisha also was on the move. Elisha would go around, whether it was to judge people or whether it was to be available for people to come to ask him for their needs, but Elisha would go around. The Gemara tells us that someone who is working for the klal, working for the Jewish people, if they would like to take the minhag of Shmuel, they can. If they'd like to take the minhag of Elisha, they can. What was the minhag of Shmuel? The minhag of Shmuel was he had a mobile home. He had a trailer. He did not accept any lodging or food from anybody else. He took what he needed with him. And he remained completely independent of the people, which allowed him to be a judge. Because no one could claim that Shmuel owed them anything. He stayed completely separate from the people in that way. Elisha does not have that minhag. Now, Elisha does not appear to have been a judge. Elisha seems to just simply have gone out to help the people. And he does not take that minhag. He has the opposite minhag. He is willing to take help from others. And that's what happens over here. V'sham Isha Gedola, there was a great woman. There in Shunem, there was a great woman. Batachazek bo lechol lochem, she, now tachazek could mean to grab hold. It doesn't mean she physically grabbed hold of him. It means that she insisted. She insisted that he come to eat bread, that he eat a meal with her family. Vayihimi de avro, and it would be whenever he would pass by Shunem, yasur shama lechol lochem, he would pass there to eat bread. So here Elisha takes that minhag, that he is willing to accept support and help from the people that he himself is supporting and helping. Now the two minhagim, the minhag of not accepting anything and the minhag of accepting, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Brachos, are both valid. That a leader can do either one. Which means that there are advantages and disadvantages both ways. In other words, if one system was clearly better, then the Gemara should say that both are permitted, but it is best to do X rather than Y. But that's not the Gemara says. The Gemara says, Harotza lehanos yanek Elisha, Harotza shalom lehanos lo yanek Shmuel. If you don't want to benefit, do like Shmuel. If you want to benefit, do like Elisha. So it seems like they're both appropriate. So what are the pros and cons? Now, in terms of being a judge, clearly what Shmuel did is the better approach, because then there's no issue of being biased, of being partial. But from a leadership perspective, both approaches have pros and cons. The advantage of not taking anything from anybody is one is not beholden to anybody. And that means that one can be impartial, not just as a judge, but even as a leader, one can be impartial, and one can deal with people based solely on their merit and their need. And one does not have to factor in what they did for me. So that is a significant thing for a leader to be able to do that. It certainly prevents corruption. At the same time, it does create a certain barrier, a certain aloofness between the leader and the people. Now, a leader has to be somewhat aloof. A leader cannot be buddy-buddy with the people. That's not a leader. In order for a leader to be able to make tough decisions, a leader has to have some degree of separation from the people. We don't want leaders who are our buddies. That's not a leader. However, there is aloof and there's aloof. And Shmuel was completely detached from the people and he didn't owe anybody anything. And at the same time, no one could claim to be his real close friend or confidant or whatever Shmuel was. He was greater than everybody else by far. He's compared to Moshe and Aaron. And what that leads to is at the end of his life, when the people ask for a king, and they prematurely ask for a king, so by the order of Hashem, Shmuel challenges the people, and he says to them, "What did I ever take from you? Tell me. Anybody who has any complaint about anything I might have taken from you, tell me." And no one said a word because no one had any complaint. He never took anything. So there is an advantage, but there's also a disadvantage in being completely separate from the people. Elisha, by taking what he was offered. On the one hand, it means that he is beholden to a certain extent. But on the other hand, it means that there is a relationship that is developed between Elisha and the people. You have an easier time developing a relationship with him. Now, we're going to see later that Elisha was not, you know, he wasn't like your favorite uncle. It wasn't like that. He was also aloof. But at the same time, there is a little bit of a sense of a two-way street with Elisha. There is also, in addition to that, we all know that very often the one who is trying to give or to help has a great sense of satisfaction in being able to help or to give, particularly a great person like Elisha. So there is a certain giving to the giver by allowing the giver to give, by being a gracious recipient, by gracefully accepting something. The one can give a great deal of pleasure to the giver, to the one who's trying to give. So that also factors in making this decision of how much to be like Shmuel and how much to be like Elisha. But both have their advantages and disadvantages. Elisha here, as we see, is willing to accept a meal, actually several meals, from this woman. Now, the woman is not just anybody. It says she's an Isha Gedola, which means a great woman, Chashuv, an important woman. And the Medrash tells us the word Shunem is a place that she is the sister of Avishag HaShunamis. Now, generationally, it's going to be hard to work this out. Avishag HaShunamis was the woman at the end of David HaMelech's life when he could not stay warm. And they searched all over Klal Yisrael for the best woman for the job of keeping David warm. David did not have any kind of physical relationship with her. The Navi tells us, the Navi testifies to that. And because of that, Avishag is able to marry Shlomo, which and he marries Avishag HaShunamis. So Avishag was a great tzaddikess. She herself is a great tzaddikess. The Medrash says this woman was a sister of Avishag HaShunamis. Now, even though Shlomo died when he was 52 years old, and Avishag herself was not an old lady, but it still would be a lot of years to make this woman from Shunem a sister with Avishag. So there are several ways to approach this. One way to approach it is to say that it's not literally a sister. It means a descendant, a relative, that kind of thing. Although usually you would say a daughter. A daughter could mean a granddaughter, it could mean a great-granddaughter. Sister usually does mean sister. So another way that it could not be literal is that it doesn't mean biologically sisters. It means that in some sort of spiritual way, the two of them were of the same ilk. They served a similar role, a similar purpose. If we are to take it literally, then that would mean, it could be that this woman from Shunem was significantly younger than Avishag, which is not impossible. A sister can be decades younger than her older sister, and that could have been true here as well. And it can very well be that she lived a very, very long life, which is also not impossible, that she is an older lady, has lived a long life, but an unusually long life here in being in the same generation as Elisha. Pasuk test verse 9. Vatomer al Isha, she said to her husband, this woman from Shunem, said to her husband, Hineno yadati, ki ish Elokim kadoshu. I know that he is a man of God, and he is holy. He is sanctified. Over Aleinu Tamid, he is regularly passing by us, and he's stopping in for a meal. I know that he is a holy man. How does she know that he is a holy man? The Gemara tells us she noticed that flies did not pass over his table. They were living, you know, they didn't have closed systems as we have with HVAC. You know, they had open windows, whatever it is. Flies were a regular thing. flies did not pass over Elisha's table. I think about that every time a fly passes over my table. So I guess not. Not there yet. So she noticed it. She noticed that flies would avoid going over his table. So she knew that he was a holy person. So therefore she says to her husband, Nasena alias kir kitana, let us make a small room for him. Vinasim lo sham, we will place there mita vishulchan vechise umenorah. Let's put the basic necessities of a hotel room: a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp. Not a TV. Let's put those things there. V'haya b'vavoy leinu yasur shama, and it will be when he comes to us, he'll stay there. So we can actually benefit him more. We want to benefit the tzaddik. We want to have the merit of helping him out. That's a big merit. So he's already eating meals with us. Let us give him a place to stay, so he'll actually have a place to sleep. So that's what they did. They did this, which means they now have a very chash of a guest. So Elisha now, this becomes his regular place to stay when he comes through Shunem. Vayhi ayom, was the day, vayavo shama, and he came there, vayasar el ho'aliyah, vayishkav shama. So he turned to that small room on the second floor, and he slept there. That's where he took a nap. So Elisha accepted. He accepted the offer, and he used it as his hotel room when he was visiting. Vayomer el Gehazi naharo, he said to Gehazi, his lad, Kiralan Shunamis hazos, call to this Shunamis, to this woman. Vayikra la, and so Gehazi called her, Vatamod lefanav, and she stood before Elisha. Now, Elisha will not speak directly to the Shunamis, as much as she's a tzadekes, and as much as he's not saying that no man should speak to her, he's going to have his lad Gehazi speak to her directly, but he himself did not speak directly to the Shunamis, at least not yet. So there's a certain sanctity that Elisha had, and it goes without saying that he didn't look at women to whom he was not related, but he didn't even speak directly to her. He had an intermediary. Vayomer lo, he said to him, to Gehazi, Emar na eleha, say now to her, Hine charadet eleinu eskola charada hazos, here you have put in all of this effort, you've put in all of this trouble for us. Me la soslach, what is there to do for you? What can we do to reciprocate your kindness? Hayesh ledabra lach el hamelech, is there a need to speak on your behalf to the king? O el sarat tzava, or to the general, to the head of the army? Vatomer, and she said, Besochami anochi oshaves, I am sitting among my nation, I dwell among my nation, which means no one's bothering me, no one's oppressing me, I am perfectly fine, there's no need to speak to the king or to the general. Now, does Elisha mean literally the king and literally the general? He might have. Elisha was able to get into the upper echelons of government. Everybody was afraid of Elisha, and everybody, if he would come knocking on the king's door, he would get an audience right away. So he could mean that literally, but there's always a dual meaning. And for Elisha to speak to the power, to the king, so he very well might mean to Hashem. Do you need me to speak to Hashem on your behalf? Sarat Saba, the general, obviously there is no second to Hashem. But then if you take the word melech to mean Hashem, then Sarat Saba would mean Hashem's general, which would be a human being that Hashem is relying on, which could be the human, the flesh and blood king might be referred to here as the Sarat Saba, as the general, which means the one that Hashem has who is acting on Hashem's behalf, but his power only comes from Hashem. So in that reading, then the melech would refer to Hashem himself, and the sarat tzava, the general, would refer to the king. So do you need me to intercede on your behalf? So she says, no. I don't need it. Everything's fine. No needs. So it's curious that she says she has no needs, because as we're about to see, she does have a need. Everybody has a need. No one has no needs. Yudalad 14, Vayomer, he said, now apparently she had already left at the end of that conversation. Navi doesn't tell us, but she had left the room. So now Elisha wonders out loud, Umela Sosla, what is it to do for her? There must be something. Vayomer Gehazi, so Gehazi said, Avol Beinin La, V'isha Zakein. But she has no son, and her husband is old. Meaning it appears like they're not going to have children. So Elisha grabs hold of that. Vayomer, he said, meaning to Gehazi, Kra La, call her. Vayikra La, he called her, Vatamod Bapasach, and she stood in the doorway. Now before, in Pasuk Yud Beis, verse 12, it says, Vatamod Lefanov, she stood before him. Here it says, Vatamod Bapasach, she stood in the doorway, which might account for why here he speaks to her directly. She's not standing before him. She's standing in the doorway of his room. Vayomer, and he said, Lamoed azeh, at this time, Ka'es Chaya, at a live time, which means that you'll be alive, meaning at this time next year, when you will be alive and well, at Chovekes Bain, you will be embracing a son. Vatomer, and she said, Al Adoni Isho Elokim, don't, my master, the man of God, Al Techazev B'shiv Chasecha, don't say something that, now, Techazev could mean something which is not true. So, literally, you could read this as, don't lie to your maidservant. That would be shocking for her to say something like that. And if that's what she meant, then we would expect Chazal to criticize her, because it would mean that she is doubting the word of the Navi, and that's inconsistent with everything we see about her both before and after this statement. Therefore, Chazal interpret the word techazev not as a doubt, as in don't lie to me, but rather don't give me something that will not last, that will, so to speak, lie. Not lie as in not be true, but something that will not end up being able to continue, that it's going to end, that it will not be a lasting gift. Meaning, don't give me a son that will end up passing away. That's what she's saying to Elisha. She already suspects that if she does merit a son, perhaps the merit will only be good enough to actually bear the son and begin to raise the son, but who says that the merit will be enough to see this son all the way to adulthood? And so she says, don't give me, if you're going to give me a son, don't give me a son that I will not be able to hold on to until he reaches adulthood. The Gemara tells us that that there was more talk going on between the Shunammis and Elisha. We know that this statement of Elisha, Ka'es Chaya, at this time, alive, you'll be alive and well. So it's very similar to what the Malachim, what the angels, say to Sarah Imenu in Parashas Vayera, for which this is the Haftarah, one of the reasons why this is the Haftarah for that. That the angels say to Sarah Imenu that at this time, alive, everybody will be alive, Shov Ashuv Elecha, I will return to you. Actually, say to Avraham, Shov Ashuv Elecha Ka'es Chaya, I will return to you, says the Malach, at this time, alive, with the birth of Yitzchak. So the Shunammis says to Elisha, you're not saying it the way that the Malach said. You're not saying your words with as much conviction. The Malach said, he's going to come back. You're saying that I'll have a son next year, but you're not saying anything about you being here to back up your words. So Elisha responded to her just the other way around. The Malachim, the angels, they don't die, not the way human beings do. they're around. They're not bound by time the same way we are. They are bound by time to some extent, meaning they have a beginning and an end, but they don't die from age. That's not the way it works with Malachim. So therefore, the Malach was able to say to her, I will return. Because there's no reason for him not to return. But he says to her, I'm a flesh and blood human being. I can't guarantee you that I'll be here next year. I can tell you, based on my nevuah, that you'll be here next year, but I can't tell you that I'll be here next year. And therefore, I'm not linking this prophecy to my being alive. I'm linking it to you being alive. That you will be alive and well, and that you will have a son at this time. I want to mention that in Pasuk Tes Vav, in verse 15, when it says she stood at the doorway, I want to digress for a moment just to give you a sense of what this means. The person who started what we know today to be the yeshiva movement, which means the concept of yeshivas, having a place where Bachrim go to learn, which was not the way it was prior to, I think it's like 1803, 1804, when the first yeshiva started. Prior to then, people, young men, learned with the local Rav. You didn't go out to learn someplace else. You learned with the local Rav. Your father taught you. You went and learned with the local Rav. Very occasionally, you had a prodigy, and he was, you know, he was very, very promising, and he would go someplace and learn at the feet of someone of the great Talmud Chacham someplace. But it was not, as we know of today, where the yeshiva provides lodging, where the yeshiva provides food, where there is an ongoing shir that is being said, class that is being delivered by the Rosh Yeshiva. That was a new system that was created by Rav Chaim Volozhiner. Rav Chaim from Volozhin, was the one who founded the very first yeshiva. He founded it in Slabatka. That was the first yeshiva. In Volozhin. Now, the Rav Chaim Volozhiner starting that yeshiva did not start it of his own. It wasn't his own idea. He got it from his Rebbe. His Rebbe was the Vilna Gaon, the Gaon of Vilna. The Gaon of Vilna, who lived in the 1700s, he died in the 1790s. The Gaon of Vilna was not just the greatest Talmud Chacham of his generation. He was the greatest Talmud Chacham of all previous generations, dating back at least 500 years. He was a throwback to previous generations. And he did not have regular talmidim, he didn't have regular students. He sat in his room in Vilna and he learned. He learned for close to, this is going to sound mind-boggling, but he learned for close to 22 hours every 24 hours. He slept for no more than half an hour at a time and no more than a total of 2 hours and 24 hours. Whatever time it took him to eat, personal needs, whatever it is, but he learned, he literally counted the time that he didn't learn by the minute. That's what he did. The Gaon of Vilna got to a point in his life where he couldn't write down anything anymore, because he said that he was overflowing with new ideas and new insights in Torah, to the point writing down would have slowed him down. And he couldn't do it anymore, because that would have stunted his incredible insights and growth in learning. The few reports we have about him say that at a certain point from Shamayim, they offered him Malachim to come and learn with him, and he refused. He rather not do that, because he didn't want the help. He wanted to do it on his own. The Gaon of Vilna is beyond, for our, I mean, many of the Gedolim, it's very hard for us to describe their greatness. But the Gaon of Vilna exceeds anything else that we can describe. Reb Chaim Volozhiner, who had been a Talmud of the Shagas Aryeh, Reb Chaim Volozhiner came to learn with the Gaon of Vilna when he was 19 years old. That's when he came to learn with him. And when he came to learn, just to give you the scope of what the first meeting, he writes this he reports this is what happened. Then in his first meeting with the Vilna Gaon, he asked if he could learn with him, learn from him. The Vilna Gaon said to him, "Have you learned Seder Moed? Seder Moed Gemara is the Gemaras of Shabbos, Erevin, Psachim, all the Gemaras of Shabbos and the Yomim Tovim. It spans, I can't tell you exactly how many pages of Gemara, but it's probably around 800 or so blot of Gemara. Of the 2,700 blot in Shas, it's 800, 900, probably about, let me downgrade that, about 700, 800 blot of Gemara. So he asked him, "Did you learn it?" Now he's 19 years old. So he says, "I learned it 14 times. Moed." So he said, the Gaon of Vilna said to him, "You learned it 14 times, and you expect to know Moed only 14 times?" And he said that was not nearly enough. So it opened up the eyes of Rav Chaim Volozhiner like that, you know, what it means to have learned something. That 14 times was not enough. The Rav Chaim Volozhiner said about they asked him, what's the difference between his knowledge of Shas, we're talking about all of Shas, that it takes Daf Yomi 7.5 years to learn. So what's the difference in your knowledge of Shas and the Gra, the Vilna Gaon? So he said, "I know Shas like a Jew knows Ashrei." That's what Rav Chaim Volozhiner said about his knowledge of Shas. Like a Jew knows Ashrei, I know Shas. But the Vilna Gaon knows Ashrei backwards. That's what he said. That his mastery of Shas was just unparalleled. So why do I tell all of this to you? Because Rav Chaim Volozhiner did not learn by the Gra. Like he didn't sit there for days and days and days. He came, he asked him his questions, and then he left. And he learned on his own. And he would come back periodically. Every month, every 2 months, not more than 4 months would pass. And he would come back to the Gra with all of his questions, ask him all of his questions, get answers, and then go and then leave. He couldn't sit by the Gra. The Gra would he could get the his list of his answers, and then he would go off and on his own he'd have to process what the Gra said and figure it out and apply it and all that. So my Rebbe, Rebbe Berkowitz, told me that when Rav Chaim Volozhiner would come to ask his questions to the Gra, he wouldn't walk into the room. He was too scared to actually cross the threshold of the door to be in the same room as the Vilna Gaon. He would stand in the doorway, Vatamod ba'pasach, that's why I'm telling you this, he would stand in the doorway and ask his questions from the doorway, get his answers and leave. It may have been several hours of asking questions. I don't know how long it took, but he wouldn't be able to walk through the door. He writes that he was too frightened of the greatness of the Vilna Gaon to be able to cross that threshold and walk into the room with the Gra. So just to give you a sense of, you know, the Gra for all his greatness is not Elisha. Elisha Hanavi, we're talking about a malach over here. So it's not surprising that she stood in the doorway. Now, even though earlier it says she stood in front of him, but just to give you a sense of the fear of getting close to a person of this stature, it's not something you don't walk up and say, "Hey, how you doing?" It doesn't work that way. The stature of who we're talking about. Okay, so we are in the middle of the story. And Amir Tz Hashem, next time, we're going to pick it up from Pasuk Yud Zayin, verse 17. He guaranteed her a son. She is going to have a son. That's what we'll pick it up from Mr. Shem next time. Yeah.
Can we also go over, because Elisha asked for double everything?
Yes, we're gonna get to the double when we finish all the miracles of Elisha. We're gonna go back and see all the double.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.